Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Washington's high-flying hawks are in a shouting match with Syria. The U.S. is warning Iraq's neighbor to keep its hands out of the Iraq conflict, and warning ominously that Syria must change. Loud voices in Damascus are calling Washington the new imperialist, saying that it has a huge Zionist plan to reshape the Middle East. Tonight on Point, behind the rhetoric, is Syria next on the U.S. list? We begin in the southern Iraqi city of Basra, one day after the liberation of Baghdad. Earlier, I spoke with Rod Nordland, correspondent at large for Newsweek. I asked him how the shift from war to peace is going in Basra.
It's not going very well at all. Today, for instance, we went to the house of the sheikh who's been appointed by the British to be the sort of mayor of Basra and to try to restore civil order here. And while we were there, a mob showed up denouncing him and chanting anti-Ba'ath slogans. And apparently it turns out that the man the British picked was actually a general in Saddam's army and a well-known Ba'athist. It got so bad, in fact, they started stoning his house, and while his supporters inside were talking about getting their guns out and shooting into the crowd, and fortunately, his people maintained order until the Brits came, but they couldn't even disperse the crowd, and finally a local religious leader did. But there's just one of many incidents here that show it's going to be very tricky to figure out even who to deal with and how to set up a government. And meanwhile, they're 5 or 6 days into occupation of Basra, the second biggest city in Iraq, and there's still routine looting. We watched a crowd today loot the bank while British soldiers tried in vain to stop them.
They looted the bank. They were taking out cash, in other words.
Well, yes. I mean, apparently it was only a few hundred dollars of cash in the vaults, which is actually quite a large amount of notes because the dinar is devalued so much. But there are enough hungry and desperate people, and there just aren't enough British forces here to do much about it.
Rod Nordland, describe the general condition of Basra for us after almost a week under British control.
I'm here on the roof of the highest building in Basra, which is the Basra Teaching Hotel. And I can look out over a city of 1.2 million people and see hardly any lights. It's only about 11 o'clock in the evening, because there just isn't very much electricity. There is in some areas, but not that much. There's not enough electricity to pump the water that they need. There are chronic water shortages. A lot of the water is bad because they can't get it treated. And there's problems with food supplies in the market today. We went to try to buy some fresh vegetables, and it was able to get a couple of cucumbers. But the worst thing of all is just the lack of security. And the reason I'm on the roof of this hotel is because there isn't anywhere else safe that I could possibly go at night now. The hospital itself is barricaded, and several times tonight looters tried to break into it. We're just waiting to see whether they come back or not. And we're also waiting to see whether or not British or American forces manage to get any troops here to defend it. And I think they're just stretched so thin down here while so much more of their troops are concentrated on Baghdad and further north that they just can't keep order. And it's such a big job. It's going to need a huge force or some sort of civil administration that's credible.
Rod Nordland, what does that say to you about the major challenges that the British and the Americans are going to face over the coming weeks as they attempt to move from wartime to something more like peace for Iraqis?
Well, it's pretty scary. If Baghdad descends into the kind of chaos that we see here in Basra, it's going to be a nightmare. And then you got this huge religious problem or ethnic problem. You've got majority Shiites who are concentrated here in Basra, but also throughout southern Iraq and even in Baghdad. And they're the majority of the population, and they want to run this country. And some of them may have ideas about running the country that we won't be very happy with. For instance, today we went to a demonstration, and it turned into a huge crowd of people chanting slogans for the Ayatollah Khomeini,
who in Iran,
the Shiite, in Iran. That's right. And that's a situation that the United States government is not going to be very happy about at all. I mean, so far, generally, most people are happy to see the invasion if it gets rid of Saddam, but they're not happy to see people stay here for a long period of time. They want to run their own government, but just how they're going to manage to do that without civil strife is very hard to see.
Rod Nordland, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Rod Nordland is correspondent at large for Newsweek. He spoke with us from Basra in southern Iraq. Rumors have flown in the last 24 hours that Saddam Hussein, his family, and top officials have taken refuge in Syria, and that Syria could also be hiding Iraqi military equipment. Earlier, I spoke with Ferry Biederman, a freelance writer, now in Damascus, whose article, Syria, Hoping the U.S. Fails, appeared yesterday in the online magazine Salon.com. I asked him whether there is any evidence of Iraqi officials fleeing to Syria.
As usual, there are a lot of rumors. I went to Latakia today. That's a port city, and a lot of the rumors center on that city. And I went to one of the hotels where Saddam Hussein's family was reported to stay. Well, there's no sign of anybody. There's no security there, no Iraqi cars, nothing to give them away, at least. Everybody's very tight-lipped, of course. I asked around in the town, and nobody knows anything, and it's a small town where people know each other, and there's always the possibility that they're staying at somebody's private home, that they arrived at the dead of night, and that nobody knows about it. You can't discount it, but certainly there's no evidence, at least I haven't been able to find any yet.
Would Saddam Hussein and his inner circle be welcome in Syria? Wouldn't it be risky to take them on as house guests?
I think it would certainly be risky. I think that it's clear that the United States is not very pleased with Syria as it is, and people here know that. On the other hand, of course, Syria was a very vocal opponent of the U.S.-led war in Iraq, and it may be a little bit much to turn away people now who come to seek refuge. Also, there are different reactions here as well. There have been very emotional reactions from some officials that if Saddam Hussein or other Iraqi leaders turn up at the border, they would be shot as traitors because they should be fighting the Americans.
We also saw reports of young men coming into Iraq from Syria to fight against American and British forces. Is that flow still going on, given everything that's happened in the war?
The flow may be stopped at the main crossing points. That's not clear. The government indicated a couple of days ago that they were working to stop it there. On the other hand, they said we have a long border and we cannot control every inch. What's certain is that even a couple of days ago, still people did cross. And for example, there is a Palestinian refugee camp here that's in Damascus, actually, and 50 people from there have already died. And there is a poor, quite religious neighborhood here in Damascus, and more than 10 people are already reported to have died who went to volunteer in Iraq. It's quite possible that people are still arriving here and trying to get in. It may not be that the government officially sanctions it and even cooperates, but they may turn a little bit of a blind eye still.
Ferry, what's been the response in Damascus to the rapid advance of U.S. and British forces and the rapid collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime, apparently?
Shock and confusion. People didn't expect it, especially after the first week of the war. People here were praising the heroic Iraqi resistance, certainly the media were, and also the government officials, and they were saying, you see, it's not going to be that easy for the Americans. And a lot of people expected a really big battle of Baghdad. People are surprised, shocked, dismayed at how quickly Baghdad actually fell. And even people who say that they are opposed to Saddam Hussein, and there are quite a few people here who are opposed to that regime, so even people who do not like the regime in Iraq, they say, well, we really don't like the sight of foreign troops, American, Western troops in an Arab capital.
There's been a lot of sharp criticism from Washington of Syria during this war from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz. How is that being received in Damascus? Does Damascus feel next on a hit list?
Well, Damascus has been feeling next on the list for quite a while now. There are long-standing issues between the U.S. and Syria, of course, and it is being said that some of the neoconservatives in the Bush administration, certainly that's the way people look at it here, might have it in more for Syria even than they had it in for Iraq. There are issues such as Hezbollah, the Lebanese movement, which is supported by Syria. There are the offices of several militant Palestinian organizations that are still housed here in Damascus and that are not as innocent, at least, as the Syrians like to make it appear. And now on top of everything, there's been this very vocal Syrian opposition to the war in Iraq. There has been the issue of arms smuggling, at least accusations from the Pentagon, but some people who are in the know here in Syria say it's only the tip of the iceberg. Actually, a lot more is going on. People do think that it may be dangerous what's happening, but there is some sort of confidence that there's not going to be at least a military strike against Syria, and people wonder what else can the U.S. do to Syria.
And what's the speculation?
Well, there's of course some speculation about other kinds of pressure, people who fear that the Israelis may get a green light to do all kinds of things either in Lebanon or even against Syria, but that's a little bit far-fetched. There's speculation about economic pressure, of course. What is most likely in the short term is diplomatic measures. Syria is one of the few countries, I think, that's on the State Department's list of countries that support terror that the U.S. actually has relations with, and there is a chance that those relations will be ruptured from one side or the other.
But Syria has, we're told, been cooperative in the effort to contain al-Qaeda.
Yes, and that is something that Syrian officials here, of course, advertise a little bit, and then people here talk about that, not very openly, but it is given as one of the reasons why they would feel relatively secure, because they've been cooperating against al-Qaeda. But if you talk to other people who know, and some very senior people amongst Western diplomats, for example, they say that is not nearly enough. It's not going to buy them immunity.
And Ferry Biederman, if many Syrians hoped that the U.S. would lose the war in Iraq, does Syria now hope the United States will lose the peace? And is Syria in a position to make the post-war period difficult for the U.S. and Iraq?
I've talked to several Syrian analysts about this, and they are pretty convinced that what the government here will try and do is destabilize Iraq for as long as possible, that certainly they will be interested in seeing the United States fail in Iraq. The U.S. Will not be able fully to turn its attention towards Syria if it's still occupied in Iraq. But there's also a more domestic internal reason. The government here may be able to point at Iraq and say, well, you see what happens if you try to change things. Let's go with the stability that we have brought for the last 30 years and more.
Ferry Biederman, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Ferry Biederman, a freelance writer whose article Syria, Hoping the U.S. Fails, appeared yesterday in the online magazine Salon.com. He spoke with me earlier from Damascus. Nearly the entire Iraqi leadership from the Saddam Hussein era has vanished. Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday that senior regime officials are moving to Syria. Pentagon officials suggest that the U.S. may now turn its attention to the terrorist groups, Hamas and Hezbollah, which have strong ties to Syria. Rumsfeld says that no one has thrown down the gauntlet to go to war with Syria, but Washington has sent very tough warnings to Damascus to stay in line. A year ago, war with Iraq was just a glimmer in the eye of Washington's war hawk elite. Could Syria be next? Should it be next? Where should preemption end in the Middle East? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Fairfax, Virginia, is Murhaf Jojadi, an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. Good evening and welcome, Murhaf Jojadi.
Thank you very much.
So you've heard the rhetoric like we all have. There are some very long knives out in Washington for Syria right now, and Syria is pushing back with very tough rhetoric of its own. Are we getting into some kind of recreation of the Washington-Baghdad dance here?
Well, the good news is that knife that you describe is back in the holster today. Secretary of State Colin Powell, I think, said that the U.S. has no list of countries to attack. That includes Syria, and according to him, that includes Iran. I think all this rhetoric in the past week has begun to get out of hand, and the administration today set the record straight. There is no such list. There is no plan to attack Syria.
But, Murhaf Jojadi, you know as well as I do that Colin Powell no longer necessarily calls the shots, and he has said things in the last year that have not come to pass. Are U.S. plans for Iraq and Syrians' plans for itself compatible?
You know, the Bush administration would look truly very bad if one day the Secretary of Defense says something and the following day the Secretary of State says something that is mutually exclusive. So here there seems to be a schism in the administration. That is not the problem of Syria. It is the administration that must get its act together.
But same question. Can its agenda for Iraq coexist with Syria's vision for the Middle East?
The United States already has tarnished its reputation throughout the Arab world with this attack on Iraq. Anti-American sentiment, I don't think, has ever been stronger. So now to take on yet another Arab state for objectives that are not clearly defined is not going to do the U.S. reputation any good.
Murhaf Shishadi, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about Syria next door to Iraq, and maybe next on the hit list of Washington hawks is anyone who doesn't salute Old Glory now at risk of preemption. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about Syria, next door to Iraq, and maybe next on the hit list of Washington war hawks. If Syria doesn't line up with Washington's new view of the Middle East, should it be next on Washington's hit list? Syria has been helpful with al-Qaeda, unhelpful with Iraq. Is Syria friend or foe? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Murhaf Shishadi. He's adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute and advisor on Syrian issues to the European Union. And I'm joined now from Baltimore by Robert Friedman, professor of political science at Baltimore Hebrew University and visiting professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. Good evening and welcome, Robert Friedman.
Pleasure to be there with you.
Thanks for joining us. Murhaf Shishadi has just reminded us that Colin Powell has told Pakistan Television that the United States does not have a great list of next countries that will be attacked one after another, to quote the Secretary of State. But you know as well as we do, Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and many others in the Pentagon side have been very hard on Syria in the last couple of weeks, accusing it of hostile acts and alluding to Syria's long-time interest in much bigger weapons and toughness on the Middle East peace, and saying it better get in line, in effect. Do elements in Washington seek a confrontation with Syria after the confrontation with Iraq?
Well, it's clear that not everybody's talking on the same page in Washington, because Rumsfeld has been quoted as saying also in the Financial Times today that the Syrians are still sending stuff in. Armitage from the State Department is saying they've stopped. Bolton is saying that, who is the Undersecretary for Arms Control, says the Syrians might well learn a good lesson and not develop chemical and biological weapons. I mean, the point of the matter is, and to put it as bluntly as possible, by allowing weapons into Iraq, such as anti-tank weapons and night vision goggles, these have the capability of killing Americans. Similarly, by allowing Arab volunteers to depart Syria to fight the U.S. in Iraq, that's also killing Americans. And now, this is aside from the fact they're a safe haven for Saddam's people, a possible hiding place for Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, and clearly, as was mentioned, they house terrorist groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Now, the bottom line here, in my view, is Syria going to pay a price for what it's doing? It was mentioned that, and I happen to agree that at a time when American prestige is at a low point in the Arab world, taking on another Arab state is not really such a good idea. On the other hand, there have to be consequences for Syrian behavior. So my guess is that as things play out, the one high thing on the agenda is the Syrians are planning to purchase a nuclear reactor from Russia, which of course has nuclear weapons capability.
Well, not necessarily initially, but you're saying could be converted.
Could be converted, yeah, if they don't repatriate the plutonium back to Moscow. And my guess is there'll be very, very, very heavy pressure from the United States on the Syrians and the Russians to get them to sign a deal, which, by the way, Iran has not done with its nuclear reactor deal with Russia.
So, Robert Friedman, I want to ask you here, what do you actually see? Do you see a U.S. military threat against Syria in effect, or is this a kind of new degree of chest-puffing with something like a victory in Iraq under the U.S. belt saying, look at this example and come to heel?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, quite honestly, if we start bombing very close to the Syrian border to show that if they're trying to slip people across, there are penalties involved. I mean, bluntly, and I hate to be so blunt, but that's the way things go. The Syrians are providing materials that are killing Americans in Iraq. And you cannot let this go by without taking some kind of action.
Mourhaf Jujadi, I want to bring you back in here. The kind of language we're hearing from Robert Friedman is not dissimilar to what we heard from Richard Perle a year ago. The kind of logic that led in Iraq's case inexorably to military intervention. Can you imagine that happening, or is that just way up at the threat level, and the fact is that this will be a tough game played with Syria, but shy of military confrontation?
I cannot imagine that military confrontation would take place. We've heard many accusations here. Syria is providing military aid to Iraq to kill Americans. I can tell you that senior administration officials are on record as recently as a few months ago as having said that Syria saved American lives in its cooperation with the CIA on Al-Qaeda.
Very clear on that, yes.
Absolutely clear on that. Providing military help, I am not in a position to know, but if only those hawks in the administration would come forth with some substantiated evidence as to this date, we have been given absolutely no evidence. And in fact, the Syrian government has asked the U.S. To provide any evidence. Could this be private smuggling across a very large border? Because it certainly is not Syrian state policy. Syria providing safe haven to his folks, that simply cannot be.
To Saddam Hussein, you're saying it can't be? Why not exactly?
Well, Syria, as early as the 1980s, the early 1980s, mm-hmm. the United States about Saddam Hussein, and the United States chose at the time not to listen. You have to remember that the Syrian-Iraqi rivalry has been very, very intense for about three decades. Syria was against the Iran-Iraq war. Syria was on the side of the United States in the coalition of forces in the first Gulf War. Relations between Baghdad and Damascus have been, again, here to put it very bluntly,
yes.
extremely lousy and violent.
Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't suddenly be throwing open their doors in welcome to Saddam. But Mourhaf Jujadi, what about the example that Syria has now seen on its very doorstep of this large and so far decisive invasion of Iraq? How do you imagine that is going to impact the Syrian view of the region, of the world, of its own actions? Is it going to lead Syria to change, or is it going to lead it to race all the harder toward, let's say, a nuclear weapon to keep the U.S. off its turf?
To change from what into what?
Well, you know the...
You see, this is what is not defined. Syria, of course, wants peace in the Middle East, a peace based on UN resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
In as far as weapons of mass destruction and nuclear this and nuclear that...
Before we go into that, when you say UN resolutions, you're talking about a solution to Israel-Palestinian problems.
To the Arab-Israeli conflict, mm-hmm. Precisely.
Mm-hmm.
So here, Syria is on record as not only wanting peace and calling for peace, but Syria has engaged Israel in a decade of talks that in the end, unfortunately, failed. With regards to these unconventional weapons that we hear so much about, Syria also is on record in wanting and calling for a region that is free of weapons of mass destruction, free of nuclear weapons. Now, of course...
But you know that the eyebrows in Washington are arched all the way up at that. Paul Wolfowitz over the weekend saying, kind of ominously, Syria must change. Bolton coming out again saying, you know, this is the lesson to be drawn from Iraq. You cannot go down this path. They must have something in mind when they're talking about that, or is it just a big boogeyman?
I think it's a big boogeyman. I think it's a big boogeyman. We were on the subject of nuclear weaponry, and I was saying that it takes two to tango. Syria would love to give up all the things it is accused of wanting if only the other side, namely Israel, were to open up itself to IAEA inspections. You know, when Israel has something like 300 nuclear warheads, to tell Damascus, which is only 24 miles away from Israel,
mm-hmm.
That it must desist from doing this and that, it is almost laughable.
Robert Friedman, here's the message. Syria is, in fact, a pretty good partner, and if the right thing were done in Israel, we wouldn't have a problem.
Well, there are two issues here. First of all, it's quite true that under the regime of Hafez Assad, Iraq and Syria were...
The father of the current president, Bashar al-Assad.
But Bashar has changed policy on this. and has changed it considerably, and not only buying, trading weapons for oil, but also taking a strongly pro-Iraqi position in this war, which his father, you know, did not in the previous war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that having been said, Israel has also said, if we want to get into the Arab-Israeli conflict, it's prepared to give up nuclear weapons as soon as there's a general peace in the region. But that peace is not here yet. So this is a problem. And I have to tell you that Syrian behavior, I don't think the United States is going to go to war against Syria. I don't think it'd be wise to go to war against Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there still have to be consequences for Syrian behavior.
Consequences these days is a big freighted word. Robert Friedman, Murat Joujadi, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Louis Cantori. He's joining us from Baltimore. He's a former U.S. Marine and distinguished professor at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He's currently a professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Good evening and welcome, Louis Cantori.
Thank you. No.
Thank you for joining us. Louis Cantori, there's some pretty fiery sentiments and views around this issue of Syria. The rhetoric's been cranked up. Today, Colin Powell's trying to crank it down. But there's a lot out on the table from both sides, Damascus and Washington. Are we headed toward some kind of Donnybrook here?
I think we might be, but I just want to put some perspective on this.
Please.
The perspective is the following. The war party in the Defense Department is ideologically motivated. There are two elements of this ideology. One of them are cold warriors like Wolfowitz and Cheney,
mm-hmm.
On the one hand, and then there's a group of people who are pro-Israeli, Pearl and Douglas Faith and Daniel Wimser, and probably John Bolton as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm referring to specifically is that in 1996, Richard Pearl wrote a planning document for Benjamin Netanyahu on Israeli national security.
Mm-hmm.
And what essentially the argument was the following. Syria is the enemy, but Iraq is its ally. So the first thing that needs to be done is to take Iraq out. And then once Iraq is taken out, then Syria will be isolated. Well, that's exactly what we have at this moment.
So you're saying, Louis Cantori, that a Benjamin Netanyahu policy document is now driving U.S. policy? Is that what you're suggesting?
Oh, absolutely.
With what goal in mind, exactly?
Well, I think the what's going on here is that Richard Pearl and Douglas Feith is the Undersecretary of State for Policy at the present time.
And Richard Pearl, who was until recently chairman of the Defense Policy Board, still on the board.
Still a member, however, mm-hmm. of the Defense
yeah.
Policy Committee.
Mm-hmm.
So these are guys who are the architects of the policy on Iraq.
But what's the goal?
Well, the goal is to weaken the Arab, both Iraq and Syria, in order to maximize Israeli power. And what they think, and this is to some extent understandable from their point of view, is that that point of view is also coterminous with American national interest. In other words, Israel strong and militarily triumphant in the Middle East is a good thing for America.
Robert Friedman, let me get your response to that.
Well, Lou Cantori and I have gone around on this quite a bit, and we have somewhat differing points of view. There's no question that Israel will benefit from the defeat of Iraq, but so too will Kuwait, so too will Saudi Arabia, so too a lot of people in the Middle East. So to say that this was a device to, you know, to fight for Israel, I think is maybe stretching the facts a little bit. Where it comes down to is that Iraq was perceived as posing a threat to the United States because of its acquisition of weapons of mass destruction, its threats to its neighbors, the fact that it's gone to war twice against its neighbors. The U.S. decided to go to war there for its own national interest. Others benefit from it, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait in particular, but certainly not done exclusively for the state of Israel. I think that's an exaggeration.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mike is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very dismayed to hear that all this talk about preemptive strikes in Syria.
It is dismaying, isn't it?
Well, it is to me, and I agree that there should be consequences for Syria's behavior in their ongoing behavior in the past and up to this day. Of course, as there should have been consequences for Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that I really, number one, I don't feel it took the full might of the world's only superpower to remove Saddam Hussein from power.
Well, it took a chunk of it, but not all of it, that's for sure.
Well, it took all we felt like bringing to bear, that's
yes.
for sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, I think that this is exactly what we were afraid of. We are doing exactly what we were afraid of the Russians would have done if they won the Cold War.
What do you mean by that, Mike?
Well, I mean that in the Cold War, the Russians kept us in check. We kept the Russians in check with our arms race, and nobody was afraid to go regime changing. That's the euphemism you want to
yep,
use.
Yep.
And now that, of course, there's the Russians are down the tubes, and we are the only world superpower, we are stepping out. And you know, first Iraq, and Saddam Hussein had to go. I don't deny that.
Yeah, but you're saying.
I'm saying that if Syria is next, I think this is exactly what we were afraid the Russians would have done if they had come out on top in the Cold War.
Mike, we've got it. Thank you for your call. Mohaf Juejadi, do you see Mike is suggesting a U.S. running rampant around the region? Is that overwrought? Or we're hearing tonight that there are people in pretty powerful positions who are thinking pretty seriously about it.
The perception in the region is that the United States is running a Rambo-like foreign policy.
And Rambo.
This could not be good for the United States or the people of the region. By accusing Syria of all sorts of misdeeds, I think that is unproductive for Washington. What Washington in the final analysis is doing is only to lionize the Syrian government in the eyes of the Arab people.
Well, but that's like saying Washington lionized Saddam Hussein and now he's gone. And you know, the images on television yesterday are likely to leave a lot of Americans thinking that they're glad they got into Iraq and helped the people out.
Well, you know, many people also, I think, in the Arab world are very glad that Saddam the tyrant is down. This is not to say that international law permits any state, including the United States, to go on a rampage in the use of force and to distribute threats here and there.
Yep.
Syria, of course, in the position it has taken against war on Iraq, is not alone.
Not at all.
The United States prepared to put France on its list, or Germany, or Russia, or countless other countries. Again, if I could go back to this issue of the provision, apparently, allegedly, of supplies to Iraq. We have seen on CNN, for example, that in Iraq there were rocket-propelled grenades that came by way from Jordan. There were Arab volunteers that went to Iraq by way of Jordan. Syrians aren't the only volunteers, certainly, and they are quite a minority. There are Sudanese, there are Egyptians.
But if Syria is determined to trip the United States up in Iraq and keep peace from coming in Israel, what should happen?
I'm sorry, if you could repeat that?
Well, I'm going to have to do that after a break, and I apologize, Mohaf Juejadi, but we're coming right up on it. We'll get back to it, though. We're talking tonight about Syria, next door to Iraq, and maybe next on the hit list of Washington hawks. If Syria doesn't line up with Washington's new view of the Middle East, should it be next on Washington's hit list? And who's playing the dangerous game here? Damascus? Washington? Both? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Syria, next door to Iraq, and maybe next on the hit list of Washington hawks. If Syria doesn't line up with Washington's new view of the Middle East, should it be next on Washington's hit list? And with an Iraq victory apparently near at hand, should Washington adopt a zero-tolerance policy for opposition in the Middle East? How many nations can the U.S. take on in the Middle East? Can it take on all of them? And does the U.S. have the appetite, the resources, the right to keep on rolling? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Robert Friedman at the Baltimore Hebrew University, by Murhaf Juhasjadi at the Middle East Institute in Washington, and former distinguished professor at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, Louis Cantori. Tonight you can join us as well. Peter's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello. Well, aside from the highly tendentious presentation of this, as if these are madmen running wild.
Well, forgive me, Peter, but we're quoting what our officials are saying.
But you're characterizing them as people on a hit list, and what will stop them? But at least let me bring up.
Please do.
The central issue here, and the reason for trying to disarm Iraq, is jihad and jihadi Islam, and that this means that any country that is Muslim or predominantly Muslim that is likely to acquire such weaponry is a worry. And this is true of Syria. It is true of Libya. It would be true of any country that acquired such weaponry. Leaving aside the unfinished business of the 270 Marines dead because of Syrian-backed terrorism, and leaving aside the Baathist connection, which links Syria to Iraq, I think we just have to recognize that all of these countries are in the same, they pose the same kind of threat to the infidel world. And unless you're willing to discuss political aspects of Islam, the conversation really floats along above the real issues.
Peter, I think we're very willing to discuss the political face of Islam.
Let me give you three things to think about for you. One is...
Let me ask you first, yeah. as you get into that, but I just want to know, are you suggesting then that it's serious enough that a further application of U.S. military power maybe is required here?
I'm saying this. Imagine in 10 years that Saudi Arabia acquires nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia hasn't invaded Iran, hasn't invaded Kuwait. We would still have to disarm Saudi Arabia because of the ideology of jihad.
Well, I must say, in that context, it doesn't seem tendentious to me. These are conversations we had a year ago with Iraq, and we're at war in Iraq now, so the issues seem real. But I take your point, Peter, and I thank you for calling in with it. Murhaf Juhasjadi, and I interrupted you before the break, but here's a view that says we have a political face of Islam that is essentially incompatible with a peace that would be comfortable to the United States, at the very least. Your view?
You know, Pete raised many issues. I don't know with which to start. He talked, forgive me for not sticking to the list in its order. He mentioned the Baath in Syria and Iraq. There are no two greater rivals than the Syrian Baath and the Iraqi Baath.
Even though their origins have a deep connection, but you're saying today, not the same thing.
Not the same. There was a tremendous ideological rivalry between the two, so much so that the two tried to destabilize each other. Mm-hmm. So to lump Iraqi Baath and the Syrian Baath into one bag is simply historic.
Point taken, but go to this issue of jihadi Islam, which jihadi is the heart of Peter's critique here.
Yes, jihadi Islam and Syria. Syria is the first country that has fought Islamic fundamentalism. Syria in the late 1970s and early 1980s was on the verge of civil war as a result of Islamic fundamentalism, and the Syrian secular regime managed to crush it, albeit at a very high human cost. And to buttress my argument, Syria here today is cooperating with the United States against fundamentalists such as Al-Qaeda. Mm. So to accuse Syria of Islamic fundamentalism is to tell us that Saddam Hussein is Mother Teresa. I don't know how better to answer that.
Well, you're losing me a little, but I sense the extreme of your view there. Louis Cantori, I want to bring you back in here. You know, a year ago, we might have discounted talk about going to war with Iraq. Now we're way into that war, so we don't take these things lightly anymore. Is it too soon? Is it out of line to discuss this tension over Syria as something that could turn military?
Well, I think it's out of line in terms of those statements on the one hand, and then the reality of American domestic politics on the other.
What do you mean exactly?
Well, there's a forthcoming presidential election. There's a whole problem about what, in fact, is ultimately going to happen in Afghanistan, and there's also this problem now of resolving you know, the consequences of aggression in Iraq. So,
America's hands are full, but for that, maybe.
I think
but
the American plate is pretty full. But I just want to return to this point I made already.
Yes.
I made this point about this 1996 document. That document cannot be ignored.
By John Bolton, the office with John Bolton?
By Richard Pearl and Douglas Faith.
For Mr. Netanyahu in Israel.
For Mr. Netanyahu. And so what we're trying to do tonight is we're trying to do what you just said. We're trying to understand where did Syria come from out of the blue at this moment in time. And I'm going to disagree with one or more of my colleagues in the following respect. This reminds me of exactly the build-up to the Iraqi war, and that is that the statements that have been made tonight are without any factual basis. Rumsfeld has come out and said there was military assistance provided to Syria. He didn't provide any proof for that.
But he said they're sending in night vision goggles.
Of course he said that. But where's the evidence of it?
Exactly.
It's not there. None has been forthcoming. Now, if they were there, he's got troops on the ground. He could have had a television show where he showed this equipment. He hasn't done that.
So you're saying he's building a ramp to a predetermined goal?
I think so. I think there's an element of that. Now, there's something more going on, and now I just want to get more analytical.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on is that one of the old Arab nationalist regimes has now fallen.
Mm-hmm.
It was the regime that was going to finally stand up to the Americans and the Israelis, and it failed. The remaining regime is Syria. So Bashar has on his shoulders the responsibility of Arab leadership carrying the struggle to America and to the Israelis.
Bashar al-Assad, president of Syria, must feel very heavy tonight.
Exactly. I'm agreeing with some things that have been said already.
Mm-hmm.
We can expect Syria now to be a little bit interfering and a little bit meddlesome.
And not eager to make the Iraq project terribly easy. Eli's calling from Madison,
exactly.
Wisconsin. Hi, Eli. You're on the air.
Yeah, exactly the point. Yeah.
Eli,
come on
in.
I wanted to ask what all of your guests thought would be the possible consequences from other Arab governments if military conflict did happen between the United States and Syria in terms of perhaps an oil embargo or even backing Syria with military aid. Because I got to say, I'm pretty scared at this point of this country getting led into, you know, a Middle East world war.
War after war.
Not just war after war, but one huge cataclysm.
Eli, we've got it, and our time is short, so forgive me, but I want to go. Robert Friedman, Louis Cantore is saying there's too much on the U.S. plate for this to happen right now, but we better believe that there are serious stakes and views here. Eli asks, does this lead us into a kind of cataclysm in the Middle East?
I think we're tending to over-exaggerate the situation. President Bush, as early as November 2001, in the same time he was talking about a two-state solution for the Arab-Israeli conflict, assuming the Palestinians gave up terrorism, then two states living together in peace, he began to warn and threaten the Iraqis.
Mm-hmm.
This was a long-developed policy. Right now, you have certain members of the administration saying one thing, certain members of the administration saying another thing.
But Louis Cantore points back to a 1996 origin.
Again, what you have now is a situation in Syria that's come up in the last week. You haven't heard President Bush speak about it the way he spoke about Iraq in November of 2001.
Hmm.
A lot of it is tactics. A lot of it is bluffing. I think the whole purpose of these statements is, to the greatest degree possible, to deter the Syrians from allowing more stuff in or more volunteers in.
And to use the leverage of the new United States position there. Yes, please.
Let me just finish the point.
Mm-hmm.
If, however, there really is an attempt by Syria to destabilize the Iraqi regime, and hopefully a democratic Iraqi regime, which the United States is trying to build, that's very, very, very serious. Whether they can destabilize it is another question, but if they try hard with some success, then Syria may feel the consequences.
There's a lot serious on our plates tonight, but we're out of time. Robert Friedman, professor of political science at Baltimore Hebrew University and visiting professor at Johns Hopkins, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Murhaf Juejadi, adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Louis Cantore, former of West Point, now distinguished visiting lecturer at the State Department, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much, John.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. one doesn't expect anything from poetry, Paul Muldoon said when he learned earlier this week that he had won this year's Pulitzer Prize for poetry for his collection Moy, Sand, and Gravel. But readers of the Irish-born poet have learned to expect the humor and insight that led one critic to call him the most playful, elusive, and inventive poet now writing. This week we're hearing from some of this year's Pulitzer Prize winners discussing their work. Here, Paul Muldoon reflects on the role of poetry in a world facing war.
It's at moments when we are emotionally disturbed, as it were, that we reach for a poem. And I think there's a realization, even among those who generally don't read poetry, and that is, after all, most of us most of the time, that poetry may indeed be equal to some of those moments, the moments when it's particularly hard for us to make sense of who we are in the world and what is happening to us. And that, again, is simply, if one may use the word simply, what poetry is attempting to do. That's true of so many of the arts. We're attempting to make sense of ourselves in the hope that others might look over our shoulders, perhaps along the way, few though they may be, and connect with whatever emotional charge, and I think finally, even in the most apparently intellectually arid poetry, there has to be some kind of emotional charge. Robert Frost has a wonderful phrase, which I'm sure you'll remember, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. Now, whether or not poetry, however capable it is of being equal to those moments of complexity in the world, whether or not it truly stands us in any great stead when we're trying to deal with a war, for example, is another issue. I myself feel that it does actually help us understand, helps us contextualize any of our experiences, including the experience of a nation at war. I'm particularly struck, I suppose, in this situation by my own experience in Northern Ireland, where we've had 30 or more years of a sense among both citizens and poets to make sense of things. One of the things that poetry or any art form may manage is to allow us to take a position, to use our imaginations to try to determine what another position might be. And I think that one of the things that's been happening in Northern Ireland, indeed, is that the imagination has come into play. And people, and put very crudely, politicians, for example, are doing a somewhat better job, though it may not appear so every day, of psyching themselves into each other's positions. And something along those lines absolutely has to happen, I think, in all these areas of national and international distress. There's a poem called White Thorns. The paling posts we would tap into the ground with the flat of a spade more than 30 years ago, hammering them home then with a sledge and stringing them with wire to keep our oats from miller's barley. Our maxed out, multi-layered white thorns, affording us a broader, deeper shade than we ever decently hoped to know. So far-fetched, does it seem, so far-flung from the hedge under which we now sit down to parley.
Paul Muldoon, this year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for his collection Moy, Sand, and Gravel. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this